And we are back. Black and a Half, episode number 115.
115. Moving on up.
I like how you repeat it.
Like, yeah, you know, I just feel like I'm so quiet sometimes. I got to just like jump in.
You got to emphasize the
right
number in case. Well, I'm Silas Lindenstein, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And I'm Samantha Rund.
Yes. And we are the hosts that bring all the boys to the yard.
That's right. It's better than yours.
Yes. today is two things. First off, if you're watching the video of this, you can see I'm in a different camera position. So this is all throwing me all off because I've had to switch computers at the last second for this recording. But besides that, we actually had, we've had a lot of great guests who've gone on to great big things, but you know, I like to this is a almost a dream get of mine to a degree. We had the very funny writer from The Daily Show, the comedian Josh Johnson, on today this week. They reached out to us, which was great. I love not having to call somebody.
Yeah, that's a good feeling.
Yeah, they're like, no, we want to talk to you, sir. But they had listened to the show, they liked it, and they wanted to come on, and so here they are. That even felt better that he said he listened to the show.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
I was like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I'll go on that. It's like, ah, that's sweet. So yeah, he was on the show and he came on and we talked a little bit.
It was darling.
It was a darling episode. Josh came on to promote his new podcast, The Josh Johnson Show. So please check that out on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this one, I guess. You talked to him about the DNC going on, and then a lot of what's going on in New York, the adaptations of comedy in New York, and what it's been like out there doing comedy, and a little bit about his life. It was a quick hour. It was still another quick hour on Black and a Half. But yeah, that was it. We didn't movie review, and here's a little bit of news for you. Movie reviews, didn't do that segment this time. I'm actually going to drop a separate episode that'll just be talking. I'm reviewing two films for you. One is I got to see a sneak peek, Samantha. I got to see a press screening of the movie Tesla, starring Ethan Hawke. It's not about the car. It's not.
Oh, it's not.
No, it's about the
Tesla. It a Gattaca remake? Gattaca 2.0? No. Gattaca 2021? Oh no.
That would be that'd be funny. And then a new Jamie Foxx film that's out on Netflix called Project Power. I'll be reviewing the two of those on the next episode. This will drop this week. And we may be seeing more of that, me dropping these reviews on other episodes so that I don't take too long on this one. You know, I do it for you, folks.
An extra little.
You know, I just feel like, Samantha, like when we have these guests become so interesting.
Yeah.
And I want to hear about them. And I'm like, I don't even give a shit about my movie review. Right?
Oh, and you dropped an S-bomb, too.
I drop a lot of bombs.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Okay.
Was that one in particular? I'll use the bidet and clean it up.
That's wonderful.
So we did that. And that's it. If you do like the show, too, you know what? I was watching some social media stuff this weekend, mm-hmm. Samantha.
And yeah.
Do you know one of the best ways to help people spread the word about a show is to go on Apple Podcasts and write a review and rate it? That's like the best way.
Are you hot dog? Darn tootin'.
Yeah. It's a darling thing to do.
It is actually. Yeah. And, you know, I'm always saying if there's a favorite line or something we say, please let us know. Yeah. It would be awesome if you let us know there with a 5-star review. You could even say, I liked Samantha's shirt.
Even you know, if you just listen
as
to the
I
podcast,
twirl my hair, yeah. even if you that's right, even you if you just listen to it, you just could feel this good shirt energy.
It's a good
coming.
Shirt vibe coming.
It's a
from
good
you.
Shirt feeling.
They're like, I bet it's a pink shirt. I bet she's wearing pink. Do that, share. If you like, if you want to become a big fan, if you want to join the league, we have a special league. Some people don't know. It's a league of extraordinary listeners. You do that by becoming one of our patrons and be going on to patreon.com/blackandahalf. And you can become, you can join our league, which, you know, we'll get special extra benefits, once, you know, COVID's allowing us to be outside and stuff. But you'll get benefits, but then you'll also, you'll just be pretty cool. And it starts at $1, just $1 a month.
That's a deal.
That's a deal. And a big shout out to the people who have become our inner circle members. Tara Widener, Stefan Ward, Keith Nagel. Big thanks to you for supporting this show and making everything, making this all possible. Making my dreams come true of getting a Daily Show writer on here. That's, you know, it's because of you. So thank you. Yeah, and also the other ways to support this podcast is if you are in the Seattle area and looking to buy or sell a home, I can help that out with you during my day job, right? So go to silasgetsreal.com and message me. You can message me here too, silas@blackandahalf.com. It all goes to the same place. Let's be honest. I'm not the only one offering great services though, outside of this entertaining podcast.
Oh, why thank you. You're referring to me. Yeah,
you can't see my finger.
So darling of you. I actually really like the word darling. I don't hear it that often, so that's why I'm using it so much right now. Right? You get it.
It's solid.
You get it. Yeah. So yes, like Silas was mentioning, I offer, as you may know, performance training. So if you're looking to help improve your life through empowering yourself even more and voice, body, and mind using performance skills for almost anything, right? You can always message me at beyondtechniquecoaching@gmail.com. And I do also have a podcast I started with that called Beyond Technique with Samantha Round. 2 episodes out right now. Some awesome guests. We're going to get Silas on eventually, but you hear us right now.
Like,
so
I'm
not saying that. I'm just saying we're going to...
Saying you don't need too much right now.
Well, I would ask you different questions.
They don't want
to OD. It would not be
Silas.
The 7, or do they?
Maybe, yeah. They need a little chocolate in their life. They need a mocha.
Yeah, this episode is a mocha heavy. It's a mocha-licious episode.
It is.
It's the title of the episode right there. Mocha-licious darlings.
Josh Thompson in them. Okay. Yeah. So listen up. Episode 115, Josh Johnson and the Mochalicious Starlings.
Stand by to receive our transmission. Stand by to receive our transmission. Stand by, stand by.
And you're in New York right now?
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn.
I mean,
how is it?
Yeah.
You know, I'm gonna live forever. It's doing great.
Yes.
You know, it's been good. I mean, I think that New York had that flare up and is in a weird way, because it's hard to even fathom, because we're a disgusting city, but we're relatively safe now, which is crazy. It seems like a lie. Like if someone told me that right now New York was safer than like Arizona, where there's actually space, I wouldn't believe them. But
right.
But are people like wearing masks and like, you know, being responsible?
There are a handful of places where people are like blatantly not taking it seriously and stuff. But for the most part, there's like widespread mask wearing and social distancing. And then like even the events people have been holding have been in line with social distance events. Like they've capped it at like this really low cap, and then everyone's pretty far apart. And, you know, so I think that's the other thing, is that there's been some slight return to a bit of normalcy, because everything can happen, but in this new and restrictive way. But also, I mean, it's still like, I have a couple friends who like moved here during the pandemic, and I was like, what are you doing? Why would you already have to make sure that your body doesn't fail you. I don't know why you're trying to also ruin your bank account.
I'm sorry to laugh, but like, I'm laughing because I definitely know I've had like conversations with certain people talking about like moving and just artist pressure of like what we want to be doing. And it's like, dude, it's a pandemic. Like your first concern is your health, right?
Like, yeah. It's like, you're not going to impress anybody if you're dead.
No.
Well,
it's such a weird, like, I think that there's a sickness that Americans have towards like progress and productivity that even coronavirus cannot outdo it. Like even in the midst of a pandemic, you're still like, yeah, but am I like grinding as hard as I can possibly grind? You know what I mean? Like, I know I'm in this hospital bed and I'm crippling. I'm crippling under the weight of all of the medical bills piling up in the background, but I can't even hear that over the strumming and rustling my fingers together of all those bills, all of those like $50 bills, all of those bills are going to pay these bills, you know? Uh-huh. It's like everything about like that hustle culture, everything like that, there's like always an answer for it. It's like a new religion. And in the midst of the pandemic, there are still mm-hmm. people who are desperately trying to like validate it, even though their experience speaks to something that's totally the opposite. Like if you, I mean, it's like you were grinding and you hustled and it was all great, but you also got laid off and your side hustle depends on, you know, people being able to go out, which they can't right now. It's like there's something about stillness and about reflection and just letting things be that is distinctly counter to our culture.
Yeah, you know? For sure. I think people take on too much responsibility. I feel like there are some people who don't take on any responsibility.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of people that, you know, with that say, hustle, like I'm going to make my way, I'm going to this, I'm going to that. And not really taking into account the systems in place that are making it hard to do that, or the conditions in place and all the other factors to where it's like, you know what, give yourself a break and just like focus on yourself, like what your necessities are in order to live. Like just live.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I applaud any person that's trying to overcome their situation or trying to persevere in the face of something. I think that's actually, just to almost counter to what I said, is also something that I think isn't distinctly American, but it exists in a lot of like American folklore, and a lot of our American heroes have those qualities and stuff. But you also have to have some level of being able to look at reality for what it is. Not saying you won't do anything about it, but accept things for what they are at the present moment. And then that's the best way to proceed. So, you know, you're seeing it now. It's like there are certain places where there was such a rush to reopen, or there was such a rush to save the economy, that it's like, well, now you're tanking it, because now you rushed and you got a bunch of people sick, or you rushed and there actually wasn't the demand to meet the supply. Like sometimes you have to just meet the moment where it is. And that's not a capitalist ideal. Like even though there is a lot of talk of free market, and there's a lot of talk of, you know, being at the right place at the right time and serving an underserved market and everything, there's also not a lot of patience and not a lot of thought towards maybe right now isn't the best time for growth. No company wants to hear you say that. They'll fire you if you're like, hey, maybe this isn't our year, you know, just maybe. Yeah.
Well, and there's types of growth that it's done on the inside. It's the quiet growth that leads to the bigger growth too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you can definitely see which companies right now. No, but I think that one of the things the pandemic will show without a doubt is the people who, for the most part, are actually bad at business and have been this whole time and have just been very lucky and they've been living in a surplus and they've been able to make these widespread mistakes because there was so much free flowing money around that, yeah, I'll buy your $30 t-shirt that just has a dot on it. Or, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think that people were able to engage in silly things or things they didn't really need or things that were kind of a bad idea just to try it because we were living in a time where obviously it wasn't great for everybody and it never has been, but we were in a state of economic growth and economic wealth that, you know, when you look at the stock market, you look at other certain sectors, it was unprecedented. And now you're going to see the people who are either just kind of talking a good game or got greedy and did too much expanding. So now you have to downsize, and in your downsizing, your business is going to fall apart. It's like there's levels to business that are, you know, they almost seem counterintuitive because it's like maybe in your startup and you do all these series of raising money and everything. And then 15 years after that, maybe you take another year where you're like, we're just going to enjoy where we are right now because the capitalist nature that is going to make us expand and overextend ourselves for no reason is actually a bit sick and it's going to lead to our business failing.
Do you know who Gary Vaynerchuk is?
Yeah.
So like I listen to stuff a lot to try to motivate me and key things I like, but I have not turned him on since this started because I was like, I don't need you telling me just to hustle right now. Like you know what? I'm going to take this break. And even over the last couple of weeks, I've been listening to a lot of like happiness podcasts, like the Happiness Lab. Shout out to them.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
just to like think about like remind myself I need to de-stress. You know, I've spent so much time because my people that listen to the program know so my wife has lupus, like a mild case, somewhat mild case. Mm-hmm. But what triggers that is stress. So I spend a good deal of my life trying to keep stress out of her life and mm-hmm. really haven't thought about it for myself because I'm like, I'm always, oh, no, I'm good to go. I'm doing, I got comedy over here. I'm doing real estate. I'm doing the podcast. I'm doing all these different things. And now I kind of, you know, when they locked down my day job and my night job, I'm like, well, I guess I just got to calm down for a little bit here. And there's been a level that I've been able to embrace and just enjoy painting my house and working on my garden, you know, and just going, wow. And sort of feeling some sort of sense of calm and going like, I need to figure out how to maintain this as I move forward. And everything,
you know, I'm totally jumping in because I'm just fine. Excited about that. Because like, I noticed you gave yourself two physical things to do. They're physical things to do that improve your home.
What?
You're painting and physical? You're gardening.
Oh,
and yeah. They're physical activities. Yeah. I'm just saying,
I'd rather not paint my house, but.
Well, you're still doing something physical. Do you know what I mean? That helps with your, you know, stress maintenance.
No, I'm not sure we would have picked happy blue had this not happened. How about this? This will look cheery.
What color would you have gone for?
I don't know, but I think I was looking a little more like modern, really sleek. And I do still think but we definitely went a little brighter in the blue than we originally were when we talked about it last year. And it wasn't until we were doing it and people were saying, oh, it's so cheery. I was like, it's probably what we needed. We probably needed that little lightness to get through the day. And I don't even, it's weird because New York being hit so hard with everything and I always felt like Seattle, we were like ground zero. So we were like, oh no, it started here. And then we kind of locked down, but then of course nobody was thinking about the virus coming from Europe or anything, and it hit you guys and it exploded there. And then we just slowly kept dropping down the rankings. And I was like, well, you know, we started this. This was us. Like, don't forget.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We've been locked down the longest of almost anybody, I think, other than San Francisco. Seattle's been locked down the longest. And so if you've been taking it serious from day one, like me, I'm going like, oh, a little stir crazy. Need to.
Sure.
Like, can you go to the market there? Like, is that okay now?
When you say the market, like, do you mean just any grocery store?
The stock market.
I don't know what you have. I don't know how you get food in New York. You just
yell
at a guy going by in a bike. Like, give me some bread.
I mean, normally you walk, and then when someone interferes with where you're walking, you yell at them, hey, I'm walking here. And then all types of goods from that. That's the bargaining chip that starts the conversation. It's like, I'm walking over here. And then they're like, well, do you need any tomatoes? Maybe I do. Maybe I don't. What's it to you? And then it's like, well, if you got $5, I can get you those tomatoes. Yeah. No, I can go to the grocery store. I honestly can do most things. I can do anything that is open. And a lot of the places require masks, and you know, as much protesting has been happening, those protests also are handing out masks and hand sanitizer and different things.
Yeah. It's a different world. Like, even this Zoom getting normal for everything is weird. I was watching the DNC today.
Mm-hmm.
And just watching that is like, it's a big Zoom party. And like, I'm surprised how often I still come to the kind of shocked on how just weird it. It's just a bizarre. This is like, it is the worst apocalypse that I could have imagined. Like, I love
really that you could have imagined.
I mean, in that it's so just.
Yeah, it's just a war of attrition.
Like, it's just a slow. So we're just gonna bore ourselves, or we're just gonna zoom and.
Imagine if a zombie tried to bite you, but he only had one tooth. Yeah. It's like, all right, it's terrifying, but also like, oh, when are you gonna break the skin? Like,
yeah. And I think
I get what you're saying. I think that
I wanted a meteor. I thought it would be a meteor, or I thought some exciting event would happen, and it's just this slow slide.
I imagine that's what everybody wanted in theory, because if you're gonna die, let's not do it slowly. As crazy as it sounds, it still is this thing of the virus has been happening for so long now, for so much of the year, that people are, and this is all over. This is every state in the US. People are slowly starting to take it less seriously. Like obviously there are people who didn't care the entire time, but then now there are people who did all the right things. There was a guy on CNN. There was a guy on CNN today that they were doing all the right things at the start. They were wearing their masks, hand sanitizer, wiping everything down. And then that war of attrition just got to them. And finally they started to be like, well, do I need to wear my mask everywhere? Do I really need to? And then the dad got it. And the dad got run through with it. Mm. Like the dad got it in a way that I can only laugh because he's okay now, but it doesn't even seem fair. Like, I feel like if I were him and I had a wife and three kids, obviously you wouldn't wish it on anyone else in the midst of you having it, but there would be a part of you that's like, how am I the only one it's like if you were getting mugged and they only picked you, and it's like, there are five other people right here. Why are you hitting me? You know?
Yeah.
And they did a whole little 2.5 minute video on it, because he also stopped taking it seriously because of politics or something. He said something like that. And I was just kind of like, oh, well, that's your problem. Like, it would be different if you were just like, guys, I think I might not be able to get it.
Yeah.
But the fact that you were like, well, you know, now that it's all political, I'm just not going to wear my mask anymore. It's like, that's actually way dumber.
a lot of people have convinced themselves that they've had it. A lot of people are saying like, no, I remember I was sick in November and it was really weird and a bunch of other people were. So I probably had it. So, but I'm not taking it seriously anyway.
People are pretending that they've already had it the way that, do you remember how virginity worked in junior high? You know, people were like, you know what? I think I lost it. Cause she did some over the pants stuff and I'm pretty sure that's going all the way. I can't imagine what else there is besides that.
Oh, that's funny. It's, I'll get into that later. I want to talk about your special, or what I saw you on Netflix. But did you guys, are either of you watching the DNC? I mean,
I have to.
Samantha, are you?
It was today
and yesterday. Yeah.
Oh, it was so busy today. I didn't get a break all day.
See, I know.
I'll put it on. Though.
Samantha
isn't
as political as I am, but I thought you would love Michelle Obama's
speech. I watched her speech first thing this morning when I woke up. But so I was actually like, oh yeah, when it comes on, I'll watch it. But then of course, I didn't even know it was today, but I saw her speech.
See, I'm on the West. I was on the late feed, so I know it all ended. But I'm just recording it. Like, I know it's all over and I started seeing headlines. I'm like, I haven't gotten to see Stacey Abrams speak yet. And so I'm like,
can't I watch it on YouTube afterwards or something?
Probably, yeah.
They usually,
I have cable. I'm an old person.
I don't have live television.
Yeah, no, so. I like to see things as they come out. Like online. Mm-hmm. Like I have to, I don't know. Like I'm willing to pay that bill every month just so I'm not, you know, a day late.
Yeah. What kills me about the DNC now, especially the fact that there can't be an in-person convention, is that now if you're just not one of the highlights, that shit must hurt. Like imagine like Michelle Obama is trending because of her DNC speech. And then you're over here. I don't even know who you would be, but you're over here. You're John Kasich. You're somebody. You're like, I was there too. Yeah. And there's no, like, because you weren't clippable, there's just no proof you even did the thing last night.
Or they did the collage of like people, right? Where they each got like 15 seconds to say it. Oh, and the delegates. Yeah. When they're yelling out their delegates, we're voting.
Yeah.
It was.
It bums me out. I don't know if I, like, in a weird way, the fact that we've turned politics into sport, like it's, you know, it's like two football teams that play each other every weekend, and I think that now, without crowds, without real time reactions, you're just seeing so much of it for what it is. And you're seeing all the posturing and you're seeing all the exhausting levels of, like, you're just seeing a lot of all, I know the RNC hasn't happening yet, but like when you compare them, when they're both done, if you had to watch both of them through and through, I think that you would just want to leave America. Not even out of anger, just the way that you want to leave a party that got too boring.
Yeah.
You know, like, you, like back before coronavirus and you're at a party and, you know, three people are talking to you and none of them have a good story. And you're like, I just want to walk into the night. I mean, that's kind of how I feel. That's got to be to a certain degree what it is. You know, it's getting to a point now where I was having this conversation with a few people now where I don't know what it takes. I just don't know what it takes now to be undecided. Oh. It's like, is your brain broken? Right. I would actually rather you just be a Trump supporter because now at least I know how to talk to you.
Yeah.
But the fact that you're undecided, it's like, were you in a coma?
Yeah.
How are you undecided?
I'm not sure.
Undecided is the weirdest. Because I can even understand a 2015 undecided voter.
Yeah.
But now it's just like, no, there's no, and I'm not even saying that you have to be staunchly one thing or the other. I do think that it's a mistake that American politics exists in this binary where, like, if you want lower taxes, you also don't want any woman to have an abortion. And if you want, like I think that too many things have been grouped together, and the parties like moral chains that they're linked to and their policy issues have become too broad. Like, I don't know too many people who want all of the things that tick the boxes for their party that they belong to, that they're always going to vote for. That being said, if you still don't know, it just feels crazy now. Like, if you don't know who you're going to vote for, I don't even know. I would love to talk to you. I'd love to have a conversation. I love talking to people.
Undecided people are also the people who are end up being jurors, because they're just so unaware of events going on and don't have really any opinion that they can sit on a jury.
No, I don't think we're lucky enough for those people to be jurors. I think too many people go to jail for way too long for those to be the same people as jurors.
Jurors are probably, I don't know. Like, I don't know who has the time. Everybody I know avoids jury duty.
Oh, well,
so I don't even know who, like, I don't know one smart person that's done jury duty unless it was like when they were in vacation.
I was going to do jury duty this year.
You were?
Yeah, actually, it was my turn. My back went out, and then I had it.
It's always something.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I couldn't sit. I mean, so I legitimately couldn't be there. But then I think when it got pushed again, I think that's when the COVID situation happened. So it was like, if you feel unsafe, you didn't have to go. And I'm like, yeah, I am around people who have a pre-existing, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm like, I can't risk it. So I was like, okay. But I was actually kind of looking forward to going. I was curious, you know.
I've only gone to it once, and they asked me to leave. And I was really mad because I was the only brown person on the jury. And I was the only one they asked, sir, have you ever fired a gun before? And I'm like, yes. And so he's like, you don't think it's a big deal then or anything? I'm like, well, no. Like, I mean, for me, I didn't think it was. I just said no.
They should probably ask the situation.
Then he dismissed me. And I was like, you're not going to ask these people? The white folks, you don't care if they care ever shot a gun? Like, just me? And I felt like I wanted to explain. I wanted to say, I'm like, I'm not a criminal. We had guns.
Well, what was the case? It's because they brought their guns in with them.
It was an assault case. The guy was in chains in his orange jumpsuit there. So it was
an assault case, and they wanted to know if you had ever fired a gun.
Yeah, like, I might have too much sympathy toward him, I guess, or something. I don't know. Josh, were you always into politics?
Not at all.
Like,
no.
Is it?
No, before all this happened. No.
Before this happened, or like, I mean, are you currently writing for the Daily Show
still? Or
Daily Social Distance Show? So I met Michelle Wolf a long time, a year or so ago. And so it was interesting when I asked her, she told me, yep, nope, never into politics. She just met Trevor, saw her one night and thought she was interesting and brought her on. So did you have like apathy toward politics before getting into a show dealing so much with it?
I wouldn't call it an apathy. I would just say that I didn't have I wasn't keen on sharing as many of my views, because at the time, at least, if you're thinking all the way back to like 2012 or something, when I first started doing stand-up and stuff, we weren't like, obviously there were plenty of things to be political about and there were plenty of issues that I could have voiced, but I was also learning how to talk to people on stage and off stage. And I think that I was doing so much of that learning that I didn't think I was the right person and didn't think that I had enough to say in either an interesting or eloquent way that anyone should be subject to hear it. You know, I think that with the show, I've become more politically minded and have sought out more opinions and ways of thinking about things. But I think overall, I, even in stand up now, I'm not that political. I still look at the more macro sense of what's happening and try to look at the broader picture to see if there's something that makes sense that doesn't necessarily tick a bunch of boxes. Mm-hmm. And it can be a bit more universal. But then I think that when I started having to read the news for the show, having to have an opinion so I could write a joke that was informed, I think that that did change a little bit of my overall perspective towards it. But we're also living in an unprecedented time where like 9 things are happening at once. So mm-hmm. I think now it's a bit difficult to not be political. And I think that while I can applaud people who are see it as a private issue and everything like that, and I respect that, I also think that the same way that being political used to kind of be an easy in or just a way to seem interesting, now I think that not being political is that way, or trying to seem like you're apolitical is that way, when in reality very few people are. So I am not a fan of everyone getting into the dirt and you know, fighting for whatever their team is,
yeah,
on every level, in every Facebook post or tweet or on every TV show or anything. I'm not a fan of that, but I also think that you're fooling yourself if you think you're the objective one. That's yeah. what everybody thinks. That's when I think that people get a bit silly, where they don't recognize that they're left or right leaning, and they don't recognize that maybe they are short-sighted on some issues. I think it's a bit silly. But to answer your question, no, I wasn't political before the show at all. And I don't know if I am now. I just am conscious now.
Now, you're have you been a correspondent on the show?
No, I'm a writer.
Okay. But like, I think there must still be a freedom though for you to be able to write political jokes, but no one's expecting you, like, because I think like if Trevor goes on TV and he doesn't talk about politics at all, people are like, that's how I know you. Why aren't you talking about that? Where you can go on and talk about anything. Like, you write these sharp political jokes, but you don't have to. You can kind of just, you can talk about bacon. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's especially some freedom still with stand-up that you can you can go and move in ways, and you're also not beholden to anyone, because you can move in ways that aren't connected with people knowing you. So that's the other thing, is that, you know, I'm getting to a point now where more people know me, but I'm still not at some insane level of fame. Yeah. So I can still take lots of chances, and I can still be completely and totally honest without boxing myself into a corner. It's a thing that I think I can't remember if I'm remembering the conversation correctly, but I think Joe Rogan said it about Bill O'Reilly, where he sort of watched Bill O'Reilly's career and was like, he started out as a guy that was making pretty much sense, that you could tell was a bit conservative leaning and was a little bit inflammatory. But then it became so much his brand that it just became about bad faith arguments and about making people look dumb, and about like totally, I mean, you see it now with the Ben Shapiro's of the world, like totally destroying leftist, you know what I mean? Like that sort of mode that they're in. And I think that sometimes, even when you're doing comedy, you can get into a place where you trap yourself in that way, and that's what people know you for and expect from you. Mm-hmm. So now if you have a nuanced take, or if you have a different approach than is your normal one, people actually won't know what to do with you. It's like when you're famous for your beard and then you shave. It's like you're still the same person, and you're still saying the same things, but then people just don't know how. That's not the image I have of you.
So you got discovered. Did you get discovered in New York then, sort of, for the by?
Yeah, I mean, discovered is a strong word. As a writer,
I guess you just submitted, or did you submit a packet, or did someone see your stand up?
Oh no, I definitely submitted a packet. Okay. Yeah. And I was also coming from Tonight Show, not directly, not like one day to the other, but, you know, I had that on my resume and stuff. And I think that that also helped. Mm-hmm. But as far as when I moved to New York, you know, I didn't have a comedy job when I moved to New York. I was still working at Trader Joe's and doing stand up at night and stuff like that. And then things started to come together.
And because originally, remind me where you're out of originally. I want to say Midwest.
I grew up in Louisiana. And then Louisiana. I started stand up in Chicago.
Okay. That's where I heard. Yeah. Chicago. What would you say the difference is between comedy in Chicago and New York? Is there much?
Yeah, I would say so. I think that the spectrum is definitely wider in New York because you have so many more people and you have so many more people doing it and reasons for being here. So I think that you have everyone from the completely just weirdly, awfully delusional to the actually super talented and famous. And then in Chicago, the spectrum is a bit smaller because you have a few more hobbyists there who are very, very good at stand up and it's what they do and they love it, but they also have a day job that they also love. So this is never going to be more than that for them. Mm-hmm. But they're at clubs and they're doing great, great work. And then you also have a lack of industry in Chicago on the level of New York. So yeah. Then you have a little bit less desperation and a little bit less worry about who's going to be in the crowd and who's going to see me and what. So there's still comedy scene politics like there is everywhere. But I think that in New York, they have a little bit of actual stakes. And then in Chicago, they just don't. Like it just doesn't. Like yeah. there are people who are very, very funny, who are going to do very, very well, that may have never become a darling in Chicago, but that's fine. Whereas being a darling in New York actually does get you places and gets you things, you know, because yeah. there are production houses and there are producers and casting directors that come to shows that will see you or will hear about you because you're a darling, you know?
I think I feel that way about Seattle too, doing stand up here. Is nobody, like, I always feel like, well, it's a pretty safe place. Nobody's going to be in the crowd, you know?
Yeah. Keep going.
I would be shocked if there was a producer of any film, you know, upcoming in the audience. So I feel safe in that way, but it is nice to, you know, it feels nice to be one of the, you know, one of the veterans people on stage mm-hmm. there. But, mm-hmm. And for me, even like, oh, Chicago sounds magical. There's so much in Chicago. There's so much more. And
I will say for styles, it's also a bit of a difference because in New York, I think people are a bit more aggressive and punchier and a bit more in your face with their comedy and their points and their takes and stuff. Whereas I think Chicago leans a little bit more towards storytelling and towards a laid back version of being on stage. Like I think that Chicago definitely molded me into being very relaxed and everything on stage and trying to be as much myself as possible. Where when I moved to New York, it was an influence and it was a pressure at first because I saw everyone doing it. But then when I realized it wasn't my thing, there was a bit more of just influence of having a punchier set with just rapid fire jokes and just nonstop, just killing and, you know, making sure the audience couldn't get a second breath in. And then I realized that even though that is fantastic, and I think that that's a great way to do comedy, I also think that for a longer set, it's not sustainable and people will actually get bored with you in a weird way. If you try to make every single line of your, it's crazy because it's counterintuitive. You would think that if someone wanted something, they would want the most of it. But then it's almost exactly like ice cream, where if you put so much sugar in ice cream that it makes people sick, yeah, now they won't want it.
Right.
Yeah. But they did want like a sweet treat, you know? And I think that you have to focus your hour that way. You have to know when to tell a story, when to have rapid fire jokes, when to share an emotion and take people out of it for a second, when to bring them back with a surprise, with mm-hmm. a joke or something. And I think that Chicago, the mix of Chicago and New York for me is what helped me get there. I think that if maybe I moved to LA from Chicago, I'd almost be too laid back and story oriented. I think that the LA comics that I've seen that I think are very, very funny are also very, this might not be the right word to use, but they're very like, they create an atmosphere around themselves, you know?
Okay.
And I think that that's a possibility because of the LA crowds and because of what LA comedy is like. Whereas in New York, if you try to do that, I think that not only will you get heckled, but people will also, even your peers will be like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, but I think that it works in places that have a particular vibe. You still have to be yourself on stage and you still have to be yourself in your approach to comedy. But I think that there are certain aspects of comedy where if you can read the room and the vibe perfectly and adapt to it, you'll always succeed, even if your style isn't necessarily built for that crowd.
Mm-hmm. I've performed in comedy, or I performed in New York 1 week for a competition, mm-hmm. four or five years ago. And I will say, like, I do feel like, I don't know about Samantha, because she started in LA. I've never been in a big market for it, but going to New York was very exciting because I felt like I wasn't sure if anyone would find me funny, like mm-hmm. on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And my last set there was really great. And there was nothing, like, I haven't felt prouder of a set than feeling like I won over a New York audience. Like, even though it's, you know, only 30 people in the room, I get kind of smaller there. But it was a great feeling. And I had a Seattle comic there with me to witness it. So.
And it's also just something that I think is indicative of the fact that, like, you won over a bunch of people who maybe didn't even want to be there. That's like a huge part of New York comedy that gets left out is that, like, people, a lot of shows are people's last resort. Like, the reason that they're in front of you right now is because they couldn't get tickets to Hamilton. So you have to be.
So even the comedy show that there
was going to be good,
even though because here we trick them with a bar, you know, it's a bar. And we just give them, oh yeah, there's a comedy show now here, by the way. So there, even the show that they bought tickets for, they were the second or third choice.
I mean, you're lucky if you were the third. You're probably the fourth. You know, it's speaking to a time before all this where everyone had so many options. But yeah. I do think that now we're seeing a little bit more when you talk about a rooftop show that's like socially distant and only so many people can get in and stuff like that. Now we're talking about people who are so starved for comedy that they're almost reminiscent of a LA audience or something, because they're able to get to come to this thing and it's free and it's happening in this cool place and the sunset is in the background and it's like magical to a certain degree. I think that now you're talking about a slightly different audience than that pre-COVID, you know, comedy club audience that has to be barked in. Yeah. It's like, yo, those people are not, the fact that you had to bark them in should tell you that they're not really here for you. And then on top of that, they don't know you. So then on top of the fact that they didn't mean to come to this show, they also don't know you. Yeah. So now you have to surprisingly be funnier than Hamilton was going to be amazing. And it's like, who can do that? And how many times can you reliably do it? And so then when you get to that point where you're funny enough to change someone's night around, or you're funny enough to be memorable when people didn't even expect to see you, I think that that type of thing is what molds New York comics to the way that you see them, the way that the world gets to experience them, because you're just born out of like terrible times. You know, I think that everyone will thrive in the best conditions. Like yeah. whenever people are like, oh, you know, I killed at this sold out show opening for this person who's also very good and popular. It's like, oh yeah, wow. No brainer. You know what I mean? But if you can destroy at a backyard patio show at a nursing home, now I think that you're funny. You're really yeah. funny. You're crazy funny.
Have you been able to get on stage yet since?
Yeah. Yeah. I've done like rooftop shows. Like that's kind of what I was talking about is the fact that
I'm like, what's this rooftop show? Like we can't do anything here yet.
Yeah. So basically if you have like a limited number of people and you can distance yourself in the seating, you can have an event. Even though it wouldn't even really be called an event because it's only happening for like an hour and a half and it's outside, whatever. But there are places now that have rooftop access that, you know, have put out some chairs and stuff pretty far away and then have a limited number of people they let in at a time. And people have had some shows that way. There's definitely a market for people if they wanted to do the show, but there's not that many that I know of happening right now. So in all of New York, I think I know of like five.
Okay. Are you, did it feel weird to go through? Like,
I mean I should point out though, that the first iteration of shows that I did within this world quasi post lockdown were absolutely terrible. Some of them were in parks. Some of them were just outside in someone's backyard. Like it was basically anything that could adhere to the rules, as close as possible, but then the rules aren't conducive for great comedy experiences.
Yeah.
So you're already outside, which means the laughs and the sound is not trapped.
Yeah.
And then in a lot of these situations, you couldn't have a mic. So then now you're just screaming your joke. And then you're hoping that what's coming back at you is laughter. But then on top of that, it's like you're not everyone is here for the show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So now you're in someone's backyard, but then their backyard neighbor isn't here for the show. So it just at a certain point just felt like busking. It just yeah. felt like I should be juggling or something, you know? And I think that now with a couple more innovative people and venues, it's starting to feel a little bit normal again, where you can go to this rooftop show and there's already people there because they know about it from last week, from last week, from last week. So now there's a reliable crowd every time who's eager to see the show, who's fun to perform for. Because it also took, I think, audiences a little while to remember how to be audiences, because not only were some of those conditions in the backyard shows and in the park shows not ideal, but you're also talking about trying to do comedy again while protest is happening in the background. So you're also like, should I even be talking?
Yeah.
Should I even be doing this right now? You know? And so I think that the Zoom show transition, like the transition from stand up on stage in the perfect world that we used to live in to Zoom shows, to then coming back out into the world and being outdoors, has been a real test of adaptability and of just whether you're willing to stick this thing out. Like, do you want to do stand up that bad? Yeah. And that was honestly like, it's going to sound glib, but like the when I was doing those shows in the backyards and stuff, that was the first time that I was like, am I mentally ill? Like, like is it really worth all of this to just be in somebody's backyard screaming? Is that is this a dream or a nightmare? Like, do I really believe in this enough to be putting myself through this? And then, you know, I did it a few times and each one was like a little bit cringier than the last. And then all of a sudden you get your legs back under you and you remember how to do it and you remember how to write. And then audiences are excited to see you. And it all comes back together piece by piece to where now when I go and do an outdoor show, I don't just go do it with confidence. I actually am excited again. Whereas there was definitely a month there, a full month of me being like, I'm not going to quit, but I think it's going to quit on me.
I was kind of amazed on how quick people decided we'll do Zoom shows. We'll do shows on Zoom. Like, and for the most part, they seem like people that they don't do a lot. Like they don't do a lot of shows, you know, they're on a lot of open mic shows, but they were like this fast. Like you can't, we've been closed for like 10 days. Like, are you that? You can't take a break. I think that I worry, like maybe that's I don't have the motivation to do it or something because I didn't. I was like, I've done, you know, I do film and I do, you know, live theater, like even live theater. You can't. I wish I had the time. I wish I had 6 weeks to go rehearse for a play and do that. I love that. Being in front of an audience is incredible for that.
You still do like a 48-hour weekend.
But film is film. Film is, you don't get a thrill. I don't get a thrill on set, like acting or anything. It's, I don't get that thrill of the live audience. So that's why I was kind of like, I'm not doing the Zoom. If it's the, I love the whole audience being there. If I can't hear them, it just sounds like it's going to make me sad. I think I'm going to feel the loss of it worse. Because now I can just pretend, no, it's like my wife had a baby. I just got to stay home for a while. So hopefully this, you know.
I think it's like different. Maybe I can't say for New York, but what I noticed, I started noticing a bunch of the people that I knew from LA that are doing Zoom shows now, like legitimate comics. Yeah. That are. And I don't know.
Definitely have seen the higher quality comics doing them now. But
yeah. Like, I don't know if there was just like a little period before it happened. And I didn't think I would do it at all. I know we had talked about this before.
I
can't do it.
I knew you would cave.
Well, you knew me better then because I didn't. I was in the like the grief stage of like the, you know, the world. And I just didn't have like the energy and all of the, you know, I had to get out of that stage. For a bit, you know, we've talked about spoon theory. Like you've heard about spoon theory, right?
Wait,
Josh. Spoons?
No.
Oh, spoons? So it's like a you know, I heard about it from a friend who learned about it from their therapist. But basically, let's say like you have every day you have like 10 spoons, and if you are feeling super healthy and everything like that, maybe 5 spoons go towards, you know, your day-to-day activity. And then you have leftover spoons for your hobbies, your interests, your passions or exercise, you know, those other things. But if you're dealing with like a loss or grief or stress or, you know, a sickness or something like that, it takes away how many spoons you have for the day. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say like at the beginning of this whole situation, I didn't have my extra stand-up spoons. I didn't have my extra creative spoons. I had like my 5 spoons to get me through the day and like maintain some sort of hope and not get too angry and all of that stuff. Anyway, so Silas, when you say that you knew I would do the Zoom, you knew I was going to get back all my spoons. That's the moral of that story. And once I got back more of my spoons, I'm like, I miss stand-up. You know, and I was asked to do a show. So I did one this past week was my first Zoom show. It was super weird. They didn't have this particular one, like the audio was off. So it was just complete silence. And that was super strange. I don't know if the ones that I'm doing this weekend, if they're going to have like audio on or not.
Yeah.
I mean, you should definitely tell them ahead of time, like, hey, make sure the audience has their mics on because it's night and day, the experience.
It's so
and
weird.
And it's also like there are people who are starting their Zoom shows even now, so they don't know to ask the audience. So they almost think it's better to have everyone muted so that way there's no hecklers or whatever. Yeah. But then they don't realize that it's like if there's no laughs now, this is already a Zoom show is already like half like doing stand up.
Yeah, it's
if there's no laughs now. It's a quarter. You know, like now. Now you're just talking into the abyss. You could have been having these thoughts offline. You could have been talking out loud. So, you know, and I think that this is also a time where a lot is changing and we're seeing the effects of it on what we thought, the things that we thought were concrete. So I think that now I see more comics making sort of demands like that of like, no, this will actually make the show better if you, mm-hmm. if you do it this way, not saying I won't do the show if you don't do it my way, but just in general, like there was at least two Zoom shows that I've done where I've been like, even if you ask the audience to put their mics at 50%, you have to let the audience have their mics on. Because there was a show that I did where they didn't do that. And I was early enough in doing Zoom shows that I didn't even know to mention it or request it or even tell the audience in real time, like, hey, turn your mics on, turn your videos on, let me see you, whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't know to do any of that yet. And I remember doing it and feeling okay. Like I knew the jokes worked that I did, but then past that, I was like, that was a little weird. And then the booker reached out to me afterwards, like, hey, that was so great. Thank you so much for doing the show and everything. And, you know, people really liked your set. Apparently in the chat, people were writing nice things and stuff, but then he was like, and then we had 80 people on Twitch. And so now I'm looking at this, you know, when I did the show, it was 20 people on Zoom, but they were also linked up to Twitch, which had 80 people. Mm-hmm. So now 100 people saw me have what I thought was like a fine set or maybe a mediocre set, but it didn't have the accompanying laughs because the people on Twitch can't laugh. They're completely separate from the experience. I will never hear the Twitch laughs that are happening.
Right.
But I can hear the Zoom laughs in real time if they have their mics on. So I think it's just important to be thinking about those little things that even though they don't necessarily have too much to do with comedy or you're not running the show or anything, they will make for a better show and a better experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my that's a great point. I will need to ask that before this weekend. But my mom's suggestion was, Samantha, can you just get yourself a laugh track? I'm going to be my own like 90s sitcom. I'll just like
hit your punchline and then press the button.
Yeah. And then press it. I'm going to just get a bunch of like parrots and train them to laugh at my punchlines. And there we've got it.
Well, I'll get you a laugh track for this show next week. Josh. So my understanding, you have a podcast. Did it just drop? Is it coming out?
Yeah. So, yeah. No, it's out now.
I think when we first booked you, I looked for it and I don't think it would premiered yet.
Oh yeah. Maybe when you first booked me, it wasn't up yet, but it's the Josh Johnson Show. You can catch it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, pretty much wherever you listen to podcasts. And it's a show that I do with my buddy, Logan Nielsen. And, you know, we basically talk about comedy and life stuff. I usually share a story or two from my life and he'll share one from his. And then we'll talk about not necessarily current events, but basically just the way that we feel about things, which is, oh, that's hella broad, but
yeah,
it's essentially how it plays out.
Is this a podcast brought upon by the situation, by COVID? Is it?
No, we had actually been trying to figure out how to work on a project together for a while, and then we decided that a podcast was best. It's definitely fortunate that we weren't decided on like a sketch show or something, like something that we wouldn't be able to do right now. Yeah. But no, I've really enjoyed it, and he's a great co-host, and he at least helps keep my stories fluid, because he's now someone to ask, like, hey, wait, when did this happen?
Yeah.
And like, because sometimes when you're telling a story, especially when you're telling it from memory, you're just sort of flowing with how it is, how it happened in your head, but the rest of the world isn't in your head. So they don't know that the guy also was 6 feet tall. Like, someone needs to get you to point that out, you know?
Mm-hmm. And is it just you two then?
It's just us. So, you know, down the line, we're going to be having guests and stuff. But right now we're enjoying, you know, talking out our stories and everything and just sharing our time on the road together, because, you know, we would go on these tours together before COVID started and everything. And I think that it's something that we're also wanting to do whenever the world gets a little bit more back to normal. And the podcast is another way to do that. So we plan on doing live podcast shows when there can be crowds meeting to come to shows, you know.
That's very nice. And your Netflix, you're on a Netflix show. I mean, came out, I guess, 2 years ago, right?
The
Comedy Lineup.
Yeah.
That's where I got to see.
Don't get
you on
people
that.
Excited about it.
Hey, but that's a great
thing. You're on a Netflix show actually 2 years ago.
Well, I wasn't sure because I thought I had seen, there's so many clips.
Looks
now
like
of
the
everything.
Career is waning.
Well, they put so much out. Like, they have a bunch of these specials with, you know, 5 or 6 comics on it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish they hadn't put them on that one. I would like to see that person's hour. Like,
sure.
And I
sure.
feel like, oh, if they put them on that, then they're going to like, it's going to be a while till they give them all their hour. Right.
I mean, potentially, you know, you never know. I think that it's different for every person. Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens to stand up and specials and recordings after this, because I think that there's a very, what's the word I'm thinking of? There's just a very formulaic way of going about creating and distributing stand up that I don't know we will be in the same space to make when we're on the other side of this. I think that you're going to see a lot of people, and this is for better or for worse. I'm not judging when I say it, but you're going to see a lot of people quit, and you're going to see a lot of people that have great stuff, not necessarily have the wherewithal to keep at it. And so I think that there may actually be less specials and there may be less comedy just from comedians happening for a little while, because in the interim of all this stuff, it's like, you do have to figure out what else you want to do. You do have to figure out something to fill your time, another passion project or something. It's a lot to ask of a person to be writing stand up alone in their room for when the world is back to normal.
For a year or whatever.
For a year. That's kind of crazy. So, you know, I definitely think that you're going to see a potential mass exodus from stand up for a little while. Because you're also going to have to contend with the fact that there are plenty of people, and I completely understand and support their decision not to. But even in these socially distant rooftop shows and stuff like that, there are comedians who are immune compromised who aren't willing to be a part of even that, you know? And there is going to be this ring rust, so to speak, this like stage rust and this learning curve of how to do stand up in this new world. And there are going to be some people who quit because of that, because they're like, I know how to do stand up and this isn't it, or this doesn't feel good, or this is too different, or whatever. So I think you're going to see layers of people falling off. You know, when the bust happened in the 90s, it was because of a lack of funds. It became hard to make a living as a stand up. And I think you're about to see a little bit of that as well. I think it's going to be a situation where you're going to have to make a real case for people to use what little disposable income they have on you, you know? Yeah. And I think that you didn't necessarily have that even in January of this year. You had people like, oh yeah, I'll go to a comedy show because my friend does a little bit of stand up. And now it's a bit more urgent than that. Now it's a bit more like, you're going to have to be very funny. You're going to have to be very convincing that you're going to be funny. You're going to have to make this an experience that I remember, because now the same amount of money that I may be spending on you, or even less than I was spending before, is the stakes have definitely been raised. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know you're 3 hours ahead of us and it's getting late for you out there. I did want to, before we let you go, we do have our 7 questions that we like to ask people the first time they're on the show, and then you can get some, I don't know. It's weird. I was like, well, is he in New York? Usually he'd probably be doing stand up till 1 AM anyway. Right. Even though
ideally, you know,
and then how early do you start on the, for the Daily Show though? Like, is that a 6 a.m.?
No, like probably anywhere from 9 to 10.
Okay. I am truly amazed on how quick the turnaround seems to be for material and jokes that you have on the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm just always blown away. Like, that happened today. How did they do that? okay, 7 questions. Just whatever comes to mind first on these. There's no wrong answers on them.
Okay.
What are you most nerdy about?
Probably the UFC. I think that I'm big to MMA and I'm big into martial arts in general. And I think that I've been trying to learn so much about it that then anyone who can teach me something or has a shared interest, I'm immediately like geeking out with. I only have so many favorites. I don't actually follow every fighter, but I do follow weight classes and I follow matchups and rumors of matchups. And so I get excited about stuff that isn't even going to happen because sometimes people will tweet out a rumor they heard about a matchup that hasn't been signed yet. And I'll be like, that'd be so great. And then a year passes and it still doesn't happen. And both of them have fought somebody else and have no intentions of fighting each other. But MMA is probably the one thing that I get really nerdy about outside of comedy.
Okay. What's something that you love to eat?
Okay. Let's see. So in lockdown, in quarantine, my girlfriend and I have rediscovered pizza. And I say that because we loved getting pizza in all the different places in New York, but we hadn't actually sat back and figured out ways of making our own pizzas that we love. So, you know, my girlfriend made some dough from scratch one time, and then we made a pizza from that. And then we used some flatbreads just from a store. And then we also got dough from a store and tried to like bake the dough with the baked toppings and everything. So that's been huge.
I'm right there. Oh. What's something that you love to drink?
So I'm big into pomegranate juice, right?
Pomegranate. Wow.
But I don't always go for the palm, like the actual palm drink, because I feel like sometimes being forced to look at the nutrition facts and see how much sugar is in there, I'm not a huge fan of, even if nothing has been added, right?
Right.
So I will almost rather, and I love doing, like, it's going to be a big thing that I do a lot now that I'm probably going to be locked down in the winter too, is when it's pomegranate season again, I'm going to get a bunch of big ones. I like to slowly, I don't actually bang the pomegranates out with a spoon like they say to in the YouTube tutorial.
Right.
I actually cut them into quarters and just slowly massage all the seeds out and everything, make sure I'm not bursting any of them.
Uh-huh.
Then I eat the seeds. Then whatever's left over, I drink that. And that is like, it's literally like the fruits of my labor. It's so delicious because it's the last little bit of all that hard work that I did.
Love it. What kind of music do you love?
I love like a chill, soulful hip hop. Like one of the best examples of it is Kid Cudi's Man on the Moon or Kanye West's Graduation, even Late Registration have elements of it. There's something about like a little bit of melody and some smooth raps and then all of it coming together in a way that's just like a little bit more like soothing. It doesn't have to go as hard as normal rap songs do. And it's not as bouncy and upbeat as your like classic hip hop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you love to create?
I do love telling stories a lot. I like if I can tell you a story that paints the picture for you the way that it happened in my mind or as close to it as possible, I'm always really jazzed about that. And I really want to make sure that I'm doing that for audiences when I'm performing or when I'm on the podcast. I want to make sure that I'm telling the story in a way enough that that isn't just making you laugh. It's sort of like taking you somewhere, you know?
What is something, what's a game you love to play?
Let me think about this. Okay, there's a game called Codenames. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
So my girlfriend and I have played Codenames. We actually got it last year and played it on New Year's weekend. And it was so much fun. And so we've played it another time since then. And it always just leads us to interesting conversations. Because then sometimes when you're trying to think of a word, you think about something else and you bring it up. And we're usually not playing it with high stakes. So it's mostly just us chatting anyway. But I feel like it always leads us to having good and fun conversations.
It's wonderful. I love that for games. And last question. In 100 years, when someone reads your biography, what do you want to be remembered for?
I'd like to be remembered as somebody that made art, not just comedy. I think it would be nice that the way that they look back at what I made was a little bit more than just like, oh, that's funny. That's funny. That's also funny. I think that if I can leave an impression in any way, that's actually going to be huge, because that's the most you can ask for. It's like, you look at, like, do you know who Errol Flynn is?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like Errol Flynn. What? One second. Sorry. Errol Flynn was Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Like he was the Brad Pitt of his day. But then if you look at other people now that aren't film buffs or anything, and you're like, hey, do you know who Errol Flynn is? Like, I don't know. Is that a band? You know? And so a person, it's so hard for a person to be remembered. It's like if you're banking on legacy in that way, you're good luck to you. That's just, I don't even think that's how people work. And it's not anything malicious. It's not that people intend to be dismissive of people's accomplishments and stuff, but it's just also not how we operate. You know, it's like you can hold only a few people at a time, only a few names at a time per industry, per field in your consciousness is all that's going to happen. So when you talk about comedy icons, you have to be at the cusp of changing something forever. And I'll be honest, I don't know if I am, you know? So you have to get to a certain level of fame by the time you're even dead to get to being remembered as you. But then if you look at what the person made, right? So even if you can't name all the actors in it, there are plenty of people who love the movie Escape from Alcatraz, or like, you know, The Dictator, even though obviously, if you know The Dictator, you should know Charlie Chaplin's in The Dictator. But still, the overall thing is a piece of work can be relevant years later in a way that a person just can't. Like, as much as you may love a bygone era's celebrities or comedians or musicians or something, you also can't fully identify with where they were coming from when they made the music or they wrote the movie or they starred in the movie. But you can take in the product of their thinking and then resonate with it. And that's the most you can ask for out of people. So I think if someone was reading, you know, my biography and they were like, oh, I didn't know he did that, I think that would be a very sweet thing. That would be dope to know that I made at least one thing that made it through a few generations.
Terrific. Josh Johnson, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, The Daily Show, I've always said the only reason I would ever have considered like leaving everything I have to go to New York was The Daily Show, like an opportunity there. So this has been getting to have somebody from that, something that's been my favorite show for 10, 15 years, is an honor to have you.
No, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you for doing what you're doing in this tough time.
And, yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. As we said in the beginning of the show, check out the Josh Johnson's podcast. Follow him on Twitter. I think it's Josh Johnson.
Oh, right? Yeah. So, if you want to follow me on any social platform, on Twitter, it's at Josh Johnson. On Instagram, it's Josh Johnson Comedy. And YouTube, it's Josh Johnson Comedy. As well as Facebook, it's Josh J Comedy.
Great. Terrific. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.
All right.
Thank you. Stay safe and healthy.
You too.
Black and a half. Live long and prosper.